We're looking for signs of eco-anxiety and what comes up as the images and the stories of the climate crisis unfold around us. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 18-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg blasted the rhetoric of world leaders in her speech at the Youth for Climate Summit last month in Italy.
This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah.
What are your words and actions in the face of the climate crisis? How does climate change manifest in you? Is the crisis taking a toll? 800-642-1234. Christy Manning is Director of Sustainability and a faculty member in Environmental Studies at McAllister College. Christy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, give us some framework, if you would. How do you define eco-anxiety, or what does it look like from your vantage point?
Well, eco-anxiety, and note that there are many words out there for similar related concepts: eco-anxiety, climate anxiety, climate grief, soul nostalgia. In each case, the people feel a certain amount of worry, negative emotion of some kind, and it can and is reaching clinically concerning levels in some populations. But many people, as in a recent poll, as many as 67 people in the United States reported feeling some form of climate anxiety at least some of the time.
So you're definitely keeping an eye on this, and it is, these feelings are accelerating. What might be bringing them on? What is causing a greater level of doom, of anxiety?
One big reason is the summer, the wildfires, the extreme storms, the pace of acute events, the pace at which we are confronting the reality of climate change, and we can no longer turn a blind eye or think, oh, it's a future problem, we have time to address it. It's now in our face. There was a recent Washington Post story about how 85% of humanity basically has now been negatively impacted in some way by climate change, or I should say impacted in some way by climate change. So people are noticing it and feeling it. And the other piece that is driving anxiety in particular, and among young people predominantly, is the sense that governments aren't doing anything. We know this is a problem. This is severely impacting their futures. They feel a sense of doom about humanity and about the future, and they don't see an adequate response coming from the people who have the power to create policy to address this issue.
So what I'm hearing you say is that it's hitting home by all of these climate events, the wildfires and the floods and the hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And yet government is kind of turning a blind eye to that, not responding in the way these young people really want government to step up.
I would agree. And I would say that we're seeing more government talk about action. But as we saw with the 2015 Paris Climate Accords, that talk has not been backed up by actually keeping the promises, actually putting the policies into place that can take us down to the low emission levels that we need to avoid really catastrophic climate change.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Christy Manning, who is Director of Sustainability at McAllister College. Her research focuses on how people respond to climate change. You can join in. How worried are you about the climate crisis? What are you doing to address it in your community, in your immediate family, in your daily life? How much is it on your mind? 800-642-1234. I was struck, Christy, in one of your lectures, you say that, you know, you never use a car. You take public transportation, you carpool, you ride your bike. And it's your one actionable change to address what is happening around you and the deteriorating climate. But you also acknowledge that your decision not to drive will not essentially help this crisis or change this crisis. How do you grapple with that reality that you make a big life change and it's not enough?
For me, it is one of the things that lets me sleep at night. I am really worried about the climate crisis. I had a moment a few years ago after the 2018 IPCC report came out, the 12 years report, when my then 14-year-old daughter, I was walking her home from a visit with a friend, and she asked me, how is this going to impact my future? Mm. And that question reverberates in my head as I fall asleep every night. So yes, I don't drive. I'm a bike commuter year round here in St. Paul, Minnesota. I also more recently have moved to a mostly plant-based diet, but yes, I do other things. We've super insulated our house. But I do recognize that those individual acts are not enough. I just feel that I wouldn't be able to live with myself knowing what I know if I'm not doing what I can in my own life. But then at the same time, I'm doing as much as I can, whenever I can, at the systems change level, joining in with local community groups to, for example, try to fight the Line 3 pipeline here that's coming through Minnesota and is going to end and has already been built, and its terminal port is in Superior, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do both just out of a sense of obligation.
And you also really encourage people to have that ripple effect, to work within their own systems, if you will, and their networks, and also to run for local office.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Why do you encourage that type of engagement to channel these types of emotions?
It's good. In my experience, and the research isn't catching up with this, but anecdotally, what we see is that people who take action rather than just sit with their anxiety or their grief or their frustration or rage. I hear a lot of rage, especially from young people, about the lack of action on the climate crisis. But if you channel that into forms of action, especially at the community level, at the group level, you get so many benefits. You get social connections with other people, so you feel less alone in your worry. You build social capital in your community so that you can get more things done. At the community level, you can actually see results. So a community group here in St. Paul, St. Paul 350, they started lobbying against Xcel Energy, who proposed to build a new coal-fired power plant. And this small group of St. Paul residents managed to do it. They managed to convince Xcel Energy to not build this coal-fired power plant.
Hmm.
So if you participate, you gain personal benefits, but there is also a concrete, tangible impact on the causes of climate change.
Christy Manning with us, lead sustainability at McAllister College. Have you tried to change someone's mind about climate change? What were those conversations like? What were you trying to convey? What actions in your life make you feel like you're doing what you can? And what makes you feel guilty? And what do you want to do with that guilt? Share with us, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Christy Manning here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing experiences with eco-anxiety and how to understand and process these emotions. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. fear of environmental doom, it weighs heavily on young people, as we've been talking about. And as parents, we think a lot about what world we're passing on to our children and their children. A new study surveyed 10,000 young people in 10 countries, including the U.S., found climate change is causing widespread, deeply felt anxiety. That's research out of the University of Bath and the Climate Psychology Alliance. Do you feel afraid, sad, anxious, angry, powerless in the face of the climate crisis? How do you channel those emotions? How do you sit with them? 800-642-1234. Christy Manning is the Environmental Studies faculty at McAllister College. And with us for the hour, let's bring in Sarah now in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah. What is coming up for you?
Well, good morning. So I am not young, and so about 10 years ago, I felt a lot of anxiety about it, but I realized it was definitely real then, and started trying to just take action. I mean, and I did write a lot of letters. I just spent a lot of time writing letters to Obama and banks and companies and EPA. But then Trump got in, and I can't, you know, that was writing letters wasn't going to do anything with Donald Trump. So, and now I'm just like, furious. I'm furious at Joe Manchin. I mean, I cannot tell you how furious I am at Joe Manchin. And then all the people online who, like, are just lying about it. And I feel like I can't talk to people. I can't share this with people because most people don't really take it seriously. And I've been working as a teacher and a substitute teacher for the last 10 years, and I just don't feel like I can do it anymore because I don't think the kids have a future, and we're supposed to teach them about science and nature. And I just don't, I just, like, you teach them about animals, and it's like, you know what? These animals are on the brink of extinction, and they're all going to die when you grow up. And you don't have a future. And it's just, this is like the most stressful thing.
Yeah, Sarah, thank you for bringing that. Christy, go ahead.
Oh, goodness. I am in the classroom with college-age students, and they also express, not immediately, but when conversations get deeper in the classroom, or when we're thinking about their futures and what they want to do with their lives, this frustration, grief inevitably comes out. One thing that I can offer is a resource, and that is here in the Twin Cities, we have an organization called Climate Generation, and they have created lots of resources for teachers, curriculum ideas, but also they host meetings of teachers at least once a year. And it's partly support for teachers, as well as how can we teach this content effectively? And ever more, there are people talking about how can we teach this content effectively, but also so that we ourselves as educators, but also the young people we're working with, can deal with the hard emotions of facing this reality. And I would also say that, yes, we are losing a lot, and it is very scary, but we still have a lot that we can do. There is a lot of difference we can make, and that is what we need to focus on. We need to channel that anger and concentrate on where we can make a difference. And every person that you have a conversation with, you are making a difference. Humanity is a social species. We need other people's contact, connection. We want to know that we're in company with others. And so to the extent that you have relationships with other people, you are influencing them because they want to be and are connected to you. And so they care about your opinion. So keep talking about it, even if it feels like it's not making a difference and it's hard. It actually is one of the things that we really need to do in this country is have more conversations, honest conversations about our concern about climate change.
You know, Sarah mentioned writing lots of letters over the past decade, but after the Trump administration, she couldn't keep those letters going. She couldn't keep writing those letters and explaining what her concerns are to various government agencies and companies. You know, as you see the polarization in our country, how do you approach that when you talk with students about how to get on the same page with climate change?
This is always a conversation we have in class right before breaks, where students are going to go home and be with their, especially their extended family, because that's where they'll tend to run into the uncle who is very skeptical about climate change. And it's really highly unlikely that you're ever going to change the mind of the staunchest climate skeptics. There's a certain proportion of the American population, somewhere between 8 and 15%, who have decided that this isn't a real problem. It's a hoax, whatever. It's not caused by humans, therefore we don't need to do anything about it. And you don't need to waste your time trying to convince them. Just share honestly your own concerns, and in particular, your personal observations and experiences of climate impacts. There's a whole lot of people in the country who are movable, and there's about 25% of the American population considers themselves alarmed at this point. But there's this huge swath of Americans in the middle who are open to being concerned, but they're not super engaged. And so having conversations with that group, and the more that we can mobilize people who are concerned and not necessarily taking action, the more that our politicians will listen to us. A wise friend pointed out to me that politicians are not necessarily leaders. They are followers. They follow where public opinion goes. And so moving public opinion will get politicians to move. And what we do about the politicians who refuse to listen to public opinion and who refuse to listen to scientific reality, I believe that they are, they have a lot of impact, but they're getting smaller in numbers, especially as the reality of climate change makes itself clear. And climate change is very polarized in the United States, but it's much less polarized among young people than it is among older generations. Young people, even among very conservative young people, they tend to acknowledge that climate change is something we need to deal with.
Christy Manning, Director of Sustainability, a visiting faculty member at McAllister College, with us. Let's go to Dina now in Manitowoc. Dina, hi. What would you like to share?
Good morning. I just have to say I'm so appreciating the wisdom and the comfort and the words that are being shared this morning. And the anxiety, it's real. It's palpable. I've recently just quit my job. I had retired, and I decided I need to be working more in harmony with the planet. But one of the things when I despair, I usually look to Gandhi. I mean, he's kind of my guiding light. And he said something that said, what we do may seem insignificant, but it's very important that we do it. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a lot of what Professor Manning is saying, that, you know, we're doing our own individual things, and collectively it will have a big impact. So we just have to remember that our small actions do aggregate. So really appreciating the conversation this morning.
Oh, Dina, appreciate you joining in. Christy, bringing up Gandhi there.
Yes, a guiding light for so many. And thank you. Thank you for all that you're doing. And also to the previous caller for all the letter writing and for being an educator. It takes all of us doing what we can. And I so agree. I was reminded of this. There was an article just recently it was a review article in the New York Times about the relatively small act of picking up litter in around us in the environment. In when you go for walks, pick up litter. It turns out that cleaning up littered neighborhoods has a measurable effect on people's well-being. They feel better living in places after litter has been cleaned up and greenery has been planted, and their crime rates actually go down. So while it may seem like a small act, it's just one example of how a seemingly insignificant thing actually can have a big ripple effect, especially as more and more of us get involved.
Yeah, and I'm just picturing just leaning down and picking up that bottle as you walk by it, and just that one small act can have that ripple effect.
Exactly. And you're working more muscle groups the more you bend over and pick stuff up from the ground, right?
Christy Manning researches our psychological behavior, response to the climate crisis, and what stops us from becoming engaged. Do you feel anxious about our changing climate? Have you gone to climate events or marches with your children? What emotions come up with you around this activism? What are you demonstrating to the young people in your life about the climate crisis? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Christy Manning after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The future is frightening. 3/4 of respondents in a recent survey of young people in 10 countries reached that conclusion. We're discussing eco-anxiety here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers coined the term eco-anxiety to describe chronic or severe anxiety related to our relationship with the environment. And the survey by researchers in the UK found most young people are worried and angry about what they see on the horizon. There is no medical definition of eco-anxiety, but do you think you have it? 800-642-1234. Christy Manning stays with us, sustainability director for McAllister College, with us for the hour. Let's bring in Karen in Rice Lake. Karen, hi. What would you like to share?
Hi. I'd like to talk a little bit about interconnectedness to social justice and reproductive health within the anxiety, because I recognize that everything is interconnected and that climate doesn't stand by itself. You know, we treat the world like we treat women and children sort of irrelevantly and like they don't matter. We pass laws on their bodies, and we do very much the same to the planet. I have worked since I was in my 20s, fellow Macite here, for social justice, for climate awareness. And I see kids today taking it very seriously. But I also feel that so much of the work that I did might have mattered individually to people that I worked with one-on-one. But ultimately, I've failed because this is where we are. And that makes me not just anxious, but it makes me sad and ashamed that more people of my generation weren't there, weren't helping. Mm. And so I feel multiple layers of things about this.
Karen, appreciate that. I want Christy to jump in here on, you know, the sense that climate doesn't stand by itself, and Karen feeling a deep shame.
I share the... maybe it's not shame, but it's deep regret on my part that I wasn't working on this issue in the 90s when, you know, if I were doing 30 years ago what I'm doing now and putting my shoulder to that wheel, maybe we could have made a huge difference. But those counterfactuals are... regret is not necessarily helpful. But I do share it. And I agree with you that all of these issues are interconnected, and it comes down to a sense of relationships of dominance of humans over other species, of some humans over others. And it's this assumption that we can do whatever we want without consequence. But we know through ecosystems, and actually the pandemic illustrates how interconnected we all are. And so when the strongest among us are benefiting greatly from our fossil fuel economy, the harms are being felt right now among the most vulnerable. And yes, people who are most responsible and organizations most responsible for historic and present climate emissions, they are at this time somewhat buffered by climate impacts. But it is catching up with all of us. We are all interconnected. And that also illustrates the moral ethical obligation that we have to each act in however we can to make a difference.
That interconnectedness reminds me of how you have thought about where your garbage goes, that it's mm-hmm. incinerated, and it's incinerated in your neighborhood, but in an area of who lives around that incinerator. And I'm wondering if you can share that with us.
Yes. So some students and I did some research. It was pretty easy to find out where our McAllister garbage goes on from our campus. And I live very close to our campus within walking distance. And it turns out that our garbage goes to an incinerator located near Red Wing, Minnesota, next to a youth facility. And so it's a juvenile facility for troubled youth or youth who have had trouble with the law. And so the emissions from our garbage that's burned on our campus, from our campus, which is a relatively privileged, well off place, it's impacting, our garbage is directly impacting youth of color, youth who are economically disadvantaged, youth who have are facing incarceration. And that's a huge equity, moral, awful situation.
Yeah, carry on.
It is one of the things that has motivated me in my work, you know, in my own house to cut down on the trash that we produce, but also on our campus to work toward zero waste goals as a collective, because there, think about that, the less garbage that an entire campus is sending to an incinerator, that makes a huge impact, much more than just my personal household. And it does good for others. And there's also a sense of accomplishment among our campus stakeholders, students, faculty, and staff, when we see those numbers going down.
We're talking with Christy Manning, faculty member in the Department of Environmental Studies at McAllister College in St. Paul. She focuses on how people respond to climate change. Your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Christy, there are the psychological stages or steps of someone who decides to act, who decides to take, you know, act on behalf of the climate, whether it's, you know, changing their behavior with plastic or writing lawmakers or using reusable bags. And I'm wondering how you see us going through these stages of whether we should act and how we, you know, eventually do take action.
Sure. So I love this particular psychological model. It was originally from the 70s, and it was created by researchers Latané and Darley. And they looked at why people would walk by an emergency situation, like somebody lying on the ground, perhaps having had an accident. It's unclear, but this person is lying on the ground. Why do people just walk by? And more recently, two psychologists at Oberlin applied this model to the climate crisis, Cindy France and her colleague. And what they said is the first step, this model says, the first step is you have to recognize, you have to see that something is happening. And in the case of climate change, just like if you can take a different route and not even see that somebody's lying on the ground, in the case of climate change, the signal has been lost in the noise for a long time. That's becoming less true. Climate change is now much more evident and easy to see. So then the second stage is you have to realize this is an actual emergency. And in ambiguous cases of somebody lying on the ground, you don't know Maybe they're taking a nap, unlikely. Maybe they don't want my help. It can be ambiguous. And in the climate crisis, for some people, we're at that stage right now. Is it really something that humans cause? The science is clear, but there are many people who are arguing that no, in fact, it's caused by nature, and therefore it's not an emergency that we need to do anything about. The majority of Americans agree, however, and recognize this is an emergency. You have to know what to do. You have to realize that there are things you can do. And so in the case of somebody lying on the ground, maybe you don't have medical training, and so you don't know how to intervene. So that stops you from taking action. In the case of the climate crisis, even among people who are certain that this is an emergency and we need to take action, many people get tripped up at the stage of, okay, what do I do? And especially because we recognize that personal sphere actions aren't enough and that we really need more collective actions. People struggle more to get involved in collective actions, like joining a local group. MN350 is a group here in Minnesota. There's 350.org organizations all over the country. Interfaith Power and Light is another good one, where you can join with other people to tackle climate action, mitigation and adaptation actions. And then basically you have to know what to do. You have to decide, feel responsibility that you're going to do something. And then the last stage is you actually act. You take the step and you act. And there are many places along those stages where people can get tripped up.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to Cody now in Appleton. Cody, hi.
Hi. I work for a corporation based in Wisconsin, and I live in Appleton, of course, as you mentioned. I notice everywhere that my corporation has products where they have plastics waste found everywhere throughout the city as litter. I think that corporation should be held more responsible for the products that they have, whether they should be more biodegradable or should take away from using more goods without plastic. Thank you.
Cody, thank you. Christy, what do you see in the area of plastic?
Well, I say hear, hear. Yay, Cody. And indeed, sometime in the 70s, there was this movement among corporations, sometimes called the individualization of the environment, where corporations put the onus on the consumer to properly do whatever needed to be done with the waste products of whatever they were selling. So, you know, the big recycle symbol, if you care about the environment, you'll recycle this, even though half the time there are no recycling facilities for that particular product in the areas that it's being sold. So it is a shirking of responsibility on the part of corporations to put it on the consumer to deal with this properly. There are movements, and this is something that an individual could get involved in and see really great ripple effects, movements toward producer responsibility, putting that responsibility back on the producer of whatever products, that if their plastic packaging ends up in the waterways, they're the ones who are responsible for it. They need to change their packaging to not create plastic waste in our environment. They need to find the alternatives. There are, of course, and you'll read about this, that some corporations are worried that young people are not buying their products because they are opposed to plastic and they see the problem of plastic pollution. I'm not seeing enough evidence, especially after the pandemic, right? Mm. Everybody resorted to more plastic to avoid getting or spreading COVID. But now we can start moving back to avoiding plastic. But I'm not seeing a big movement among corporations to address this. So we do need people to step up and create campaigns that put public pressure on them.
And certainly still a lot of plastics at the grocery store. Christy Manning's research is at the intersection of climate change and psychology. What do you think about the terminology we use to talk about the climate crisis? When you hear it's an environmental problem, does that shift the focus off people? How do you take action without feeling overwhelmed? What is your role? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Christy Manning here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing eco-anxiety here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's this chronic sense of environmental doom, usually based on feelings of powerlessness about our damage to the environment and our behaviors. Where do you find resiliency? Where do you find hope? What goals have you set in your life that you see as actionable and will help ward off these feelings of desperation? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. McAllister College's Sustainability Director, Christy Manning, is with us for about 9 more minutes. Christy, we heard from Mike and Spooner, called in and couldn't stay with us. And Mike has no anxiety about the climate crisis. And Mike says the Earth is doing what it's supposed to do. We are coming out of an ice age. This is all natural. And it goes back to the psychological stages, I think, of what you were talking about. What do you say to this sentiment?
Oh, my goodness. Well, what the research shows is that this sentiment is really prevalent among people who tend to agree that government should be very small and that big government is a problem. What some research indicates, suggests, is that the roots of climate change skepticism and the roots of the belief that this is all a natural process, despite the scientific evidence that in fact it is very much human caused, the current levels of climate change, that despite the evidence, people believe this because they are so opposed to government action, and the solutions that have been proposed to climate change mostly involve big government programs like the Green New Deal or a carbon tax or huge changes to our transportation system that require government investments, changes to our agricultural system that require government investments and also regulation. That it's what's called solution aversion. It's an aversion to those solutions that trickle back into, I can't acknowledge the reality of this problem because I can't stomach those solutions. So it's connected to a certain type of free market ideology. At least that's what some of the research suggests.
I want to talk here briefly about going back to social creatures. And you have mentioned, you know, make working on behalf of the climate fun. How do we create fun and bring joy to this really urgent work?
Well, I follow the model put forward by the students that I work with, who, when they have a meeting, the Sunrise Movement group here or on campus, we have Mac Cares, and we have another group called Fossil Free Mac, who is a divestment group. And they tell jokes. They start with little quips or funny things. In the past, when we used to have in-person meetings on campus, they would take a dance break in the middle. Lots of the groups that I have participated in actions with or done letter writing with or spoken with, they'll have art and they'll do art making together, or they'll share food together. So there are lots of ways to make these community spirited and fun. And it's so true that people want to get involved in things that are cheery and hopeful. There's nothing that chases people away more than, you know, the doom and dourness. that sometimes is exemplified by the climate movement.
Let's go to Chris now in Port Wing. Hi, Chris. What is on your mind?
Yeah, well, it's a great topic, and it's really important, as your guest pointed out, to take some action, to get to the point where you get to do something. So I wanted to bring up the idea of Project Drawdown. There's a great book called Drawdown, and it's the most comprehensive plan to reverse global warming, to reverse it and bring the greenhouse gases out of the environment. So there's 100 ways to do it in the initial book. It's an ongoing online project. And there's so many good things to work with. And once you take one of the ideas, like educating women and girls is very good for the climate. That's just one of the many different things. Once you take on one of these tasks, you get to see that if you break it down, there's lots of great things to do. Most of them are a good deal of fun. They involve community involvement. And, you know, my partner's been interested in trying to promote rationing. Now, I thought if we could actually ration fossil fuels in consumptive nations, it would make a real big difference. And it turned out that Wendell Berry, one of our heroes, actually brought this forward, too, as an idea. So I'd be interested to see what your guests thought about Project Drawdown and rationing of fossil fuels in consumptive countries.
Chris, thank you for that. We had the folks of Project Drawdown on our program just recently. Christy, go ahead.
Oh, I am also a fan of Project Drawdown. And like you said, at 100 different options, which means you, at any individual or any community group, any organization, collective of people can sit down and say, okay, we are going to work on this one. And here we're going to formulate our plan of action and we're going to work toward this. It's a great resource and source of hope. And I would offer one other one that I love, and that's the book All We Can Save by Catherine Wilkinson and Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. And that's also something that you can do as a group in a community. Sit down and read that book together and discuss it chapter by chapter. I've participated in an All We Can Save circle, and it was really motivating and transformative in my sense of empowerment and efficacy and what I could do. So yes, thank you. I applaud the Project Drawdown, and I'm so glad you brought it to everybody's attention.
We only have a few seconds left, Christy, but if you could leave us with one bright spot, one bright note that would perhaps cause someone to act and make a change today.
I would say that the follow the lead of the young people, the college students, the, you know, a whole group of people, young people I know, just were in Washington, D.C., in particular, focused on treaty rights, and many of them risked arrest to speak their minds and bring this to the attention of our elected officials in Washington. So follow the lead of the young people. They are passionate and they are effective.
Christy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Christy Manning, Director of Sustainability and Visiting Faculty Member in Environmental Studies at McAllister College in St. Paul. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.